From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Me Too in Hollywood's Golden Age. Marilyn Monroe is perhaps the most famous survivor of the Hollywood casting couch.
That's Max Fabian, the producer. Now go and do yourself some good.
Why do they always look like unhappy rabbits?
Because that's what they are. Now go and make him happy.
Next up, we'll talk with the authors of three new books on women in the film industry during the studio era. Well, we'll hear about the great influence and success they had behind the scenes and in front of the cameras, despite widespread discrimination and sexual harassment and violence. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 2017, the Me Too movement began exposing Hollywood's culture of sexual violence, which then broadened into a global rallying cry. But sexual coercion and abuse has long had a place in Hollywood, as three recently released books attest. The books examine the working conditions of women during Hollywood's golden age and the abuses of casting couch predators like Howard Hughes and Harry Cohn. We're going to talk with the authors about the vast contributions and challenges for women in the studio era. Joining us in studio is Victoria Riskin. She's the author of Faye Ray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir about her parents. And she's also former president of the Writers Guild of America West and a board member of KCRW and NPR and member station in Santa Monica. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And Karina Longworth also joins us for this hour. She's the author of a book called Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes's Hollywood. And she's the creator of the podcast You Must Remember This. Welcome, Karina Longworth. Karina Longworth, do we have you? Well, we'll try to connect with her. In the meantime, I'll recognize Jennifer Smythe, who's with us, author of Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood, and she's professor of history at the University of Warwick, and welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you. Let me begin with you, Professor Smythe. Let's begin by talking about this era, particularly since we're putting a good deal of emphasis and spotlight on the casting couch and on the Me Too difficulties during that era, golden era, as it's often called. But there's also a forgotten kind of herstory part of this. Women played an extraordinarily significant role, more than I think even a lot of the historians know. In fact, in the words of Betty Davis, for those 20 years of the golden era, they ruled Hollywood.
Yes, many people would argue that. In fact, the industry was rather interesting because they put out press releases and there were columnists who claimed that Hollywood was a generation or two ahead of the rest of the country in terms of employing women. And when I was actually doing research on this period in the Great Depression and the Second World War, I found statistics that claimed that nearly half of all Hollywood employees were women. And they weren't just secretaries or women who were lying on the casting couch. They were producers. They were supervising editors. They were presidents of the Screenwriters Guild. You know, they could do just about anything.
Yeah, and the numbers, I mean, they perhaps still didn't get the recognition that they deserved or that it warranted, but 40% of them were actually working in the film industry, and a lot of those were writers and producers and pretty high up in positions. It's a kind of forgotten page of American history, as I said. But the height of the studio system itself really saw mainly the stars. I mean, Betty Davis, I mentioned, Katharine Hepburn, I mean, and many of these stars really did gain their stardom or move to the top by having to go through a kind of hazing and sexual difficulties and real challenges on that score.
Yes, I think that some actresses did, but it depended how well protected you were. For example, Katharine Hepburn came from a very wealthy background. She had the agent Leland Hayward, who had her back and was also her boyfriend for a while. And she was rather funny. I think there was one story about her in Harry Cohn's office when he was interviewing her for Holiday in 1938. And he made some sort of remark about hearing how good she was in bed. And she just totally blanked him. And he tried it several times and she ignored him and he just gave up. And the same thing with Betty Davis. I mean, she came out and was working at Universal before she moved to Warner Brothers and was just, you know, a little mousy brunette. Nobody knew who she was. And, you know, even, you know, in one of the first days on the set, some lighting guy said, "Get this broad out of the way." And she screamed, "You know, you can't talk to me like that." Only realizing later on that a broad was another term for a light, not for a woman. So there were some women who put up with it because they realized they had to, but there were others that, you know, really went after the system and sometimes made it work for them, because I think Bette Davis is one of those interesting stars who was able to work with the system in a really interesting way, and others were not so successful.
Now, Bette Davis was fighting for the ERA, but you also had executives like Joan Harrison. I mean, there were some pretty important players in those days, but most of the would-be players, unfortunately, or playboys, were men. Harry the Rat Cohen, I mean, that was what he was known as. I mean, he did a lot of, at Columbia, he did a lot of promoting for women at Columbia and certainly made a reputation for himself as one of these almost, I don't know, could you compare him to Harvey Weinstein? Was he that?
Oh, no. I think he's really much maligned. I know he did some absolutely horrendous things, but, you know, compared to all of his other producing colleagues, he hired more women, writers and producers than anybody else. And he wasn't just there to proposition them. I think Virginia Van Upp is probably one of the most famous. People know her for producing and co-writing Gilda and some of the great noirs. And he promoted her actually to, you know, the executive producer at his studio at Columbia over the heads of several other men. And when he found out that these other men hadn't congratulated her the next day, he fired them all.
Yeah, well, there are mixed reviews on a number of these. I mean, think about Louis B. Mayer, for example, who his assistant, what was her name, Ida Koverman? She was pretty powerful in her own right, but Louis B. Mayer was known for, you know, reportedly, for example, groping and harassing Judy Garland, threatening her. I mean, there's some pretty ugly episodes with a lot of these executives, and even
Arthur Freed as well, too.
Yeah.
Yes, going after Shirley Temple when she was a preteen. Pretty disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting. And then you have people like Joan Collins and Marilyn Monroe, even Shirley Temple reporting in their memoirs about attempted molestations and so forth. So it was rife. It was just really what Hollywood was at that time. No getting around it. Talking about what Holiday was, though, I want to actually also bring in Karina Longworth before we talk to Victoria Riskin, who's here with us in studio, and she's the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. So it wasn't so much maybe the women's Hollywood, Karina Longworth, it was Howard Hughes' Hollywood, and you say he's a Trojan horse.
Well, that's how I approached writing this book, is that I, you know, it's a book about Howard Hughes' Hollywood, but what it really is to me is a story of about a dozen women who were involved with him from the 1920s through the end of the 1950s.
And the story with Hughes is a pretty sordid and exploitative one. I mean, he was actually hiring informers and detectives and people to follow these women. He was also, of course, playing the PR role. We know the picture of Jane Russell and so many other pictures that he put out there, which tried to, well, he was fighting the censors at the same time, trying to show flesh, and yet it really creating a whole picture. You call it the male gaze that we now take for granted and use very freely.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I don't know what the question is.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of trying to urge you a little bit to talk about that in more detail by stating it the way I did. But let's talk about Hughes in this role that he played. I mean, stalking, hunting women, he was a predator.
Sure. I mean, that's something that he became involved with, I think, you know, from the 1940s on. There are isolated stories of him before that, you know, maybe sending detectives in parked cars to watch girlfriends of his like Billy Dove or Ginger Rogers. But once he becomes sort of more powerful as a film producer with The Outlaw and then as the head of RKO Studios, it really becomes, you know, an everyday thing of setting up these processes where he has drivers who are driving contract starlets around who are also spying on their every move. He is sending photographers all over the country to take very specific photographs of girls, like with the promise that he could turn them into stars. And he's just really kind of keeping tabs on women who he may be interested in romantically, who he may be interested in professionally, who he may be interested in for both. But all of them kind of get this idea that he's going to make them a star, and he doesn't really make any of them into stars.
Well, he's always promising to deliver fame and to deliver fortune. Sort of reminded me in some ways of our president, at least according to Stormy Daniels' testimony and others who worked with him in one way or another. How did he use his publicity machine, though, to manipulate women?
Well, I feel like Howard Hughes is sort of an untold master of publicity, and you see this from the very beginning of his time in Hollywood, where he makes this film, Hell's Angels, which he shoots for over a course of 3 years, and everybody thinks it's going to be a disaster. And it turns out to be pretty spectacular, at least in terms of its aviation footage. But he's able to use his publicity machine to promote it as being this incredible, spectacular hit, which it wasn't, and also promote Jean Harlow as, you know, this bombshell. She's the first platinum blonde bombshell. And so he creates this image of her as this sort of larger-than-life sex goddess who will bring men crashing to their deaths. Like, the poster of Hell's Angels is a huge image of her almost naked body and these tiny images of airplanes falling out of the sky all around her. But she really felt like that wasn't who she was, and that she became typecast as this sort of sex bomb when she really didn't feel sexually confident or sexually powerful at all.
Yeah, there's a photograph in your book of Katharine Hepburn being overly feminized. And this was something that Hughes did. And, you know, in many ways, Hughes was a genius. He was an aviator. He was an inventor. But, you know, his reputation as a playboy almost made him an icon. It was like sort of the Warren Beatty of his time. You go through the list of women. I mentioned Jane Russell. You mentioned Jean Harlow. I mentioned Katharine Hepburn, Ginger Rogers, Betty Davis. That ended his first marriage. Ava Gardner, Lana Turner. The list just goes on and on. I mean, of women that he was involved with in one way or another. And let me talk about a little bit with you about Jean Peters, a woman he married, because in your book you go into a kind of, taking domestic violence and making it, or trying to make it attractive.
Domestic violence against Jean Peters?
Yeah, in terms of domestic, wasn't she in that movie where you were saying he was?
You're talking about the film Pickup on South Street, Howard Hughes had nothing to do with, but it's a film starring Jean Peters. Yes,
I didn't mean to suggest that Howard Hughes had anything to do with it. I'm just saying that we see these images of women throughout, and yet I want to talk about it from the other side, because women were getting work, legitimate work in Hollywood, as we said with Jennifer Smythe also. So it did have a kind of two-sided nature to this, but at the same time, somebody like Hughes is almost emblematic, isn't he?
I think that Howard Hughes did a lot of things that other Hollywood moguls and men in Hollywood did, but he did it in a larger and cruder way.
Yeah. Can you expand on that?
Well, I mean, I just think that everybody in Hollywood was making money promoting images of sexy women, but Howard Hughes really focused his whole business on that. He didn't really have a lot of ideas for filmmaking or film marketing aside from building these like spectacular marketing campaigns around like Jane Russell's breasts. Or he produces the Roberto Rossellini film Stromboli starring Ingrid Bergman, and then he does these newspaper ads of an exploding volcano. And with like sort of phallic double entendre text. And that was just really the only thing on his mind.
Yeah, there was that picture of Jane Russell. I mean, the picture in The Outlaw is the one that's well known, of course. But then there's a picture of her in a nightgown jumping on a bed.
Right. When she was first cast in The Outlaw, for the first few weeks of the shoot, she wasn't actually on camera for the filming. She was kept busy having photographers take all these publicity photos of her. And she actually drew the line one day after she was forced to jump on a bed, like wearing a loose white nightie. At that point, she felt like she was really being sexually exploited. And she refused to do photographs quite like that anymore. But for sure, she was associated with Howard Hughes for many, many years. And all he really did in terms of promoting her was promoting her body.
Karina Longworth with us, author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood. And she's a creator of the podcast You Must Remember This. And Victoria Riskin's here in studio. She's the author of Faye Ray and Robert Riskin, a Hollywood memoir about her parents. And I was telling her before we went on the air, it's a very moving love story to be read just for that. The AP is calling it the Oscar of Hollywood memoirs. Let's talk about your mother first, Faye Ray, because everybody associates her with that 25-foot on top of the Empire State Building with held in the hand of 8-foot hand of King Kong. But she made over 100 movies, and she was really... your parents were really Hollywood royalty. Your father was certainly one of the most successful screenwriters in Hollywood history. But there's a story there, too, about exploitation of women and so forth. I mean, first of all, She went to Hollywood sort of at the behest of her parents from Canada at, what was she, 14 years old?
What was, she was actually in Utah. She was...
At the time, she was in Salt Lake.
She was in Salt Lake. She was 14 years old, and her father had left the family, and there were six children, and her sister had a friend who was in his early 20s, and he was enchanted by Faye and told her mother, I think I can take Faye to Hollywood and maybe get her in the movies. She'd won a little movie contest, so she was very excited about this because she fell in love with the movies in Utah. She thought Lillian Gish was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. She imagined herself at a very early age being on the screen. But she goes to Hollywood at 14 with a 21-year-old man, and for the most part, he takes good care of her and helps educate her and places her in a family where she's looked after. But it was pretty scary because on the train going to Los Angeles, he says to her, "It's not your sister I'm in love with. It's you I'm in love with." And she said, "I felt like an old person that day," but it just was kind of transformational. But she also had a sense of resilience and destiny, and she was able to handle herself. It was a great adventure for her.
What did you learn from your mother about the way the casting couch worked and the way Hollywood, particularly the moguls, comported themselves
right.
in those
so,
days?
Well, she did a lot of work at Columbia with Harry Cohn, and he never approached her. He had a big closet behind his desk, and he knew what her favorite perfume was, and he knew everybody's favorite perfume, so he could open the closet and say, "Here's a bottle of Chanel No. 5." But she did get approached now and then by Zanuck and by Douglas
Fairbanks. Daryl Zanuck, yeah.
Yeah. And I think...
Which was commonplace for women.
It was commonplace. It didn't happen all the time to her, but it did happen. And I think she so loved what she was doing and the work and hoped that moguls looked at her to cast her in parts and not to cast her on the couch. And so when it happened, it was hurtful to her. It was like a betrayal. Her way of handling it was to just pretend it didn't happen, just to turn around and walk away. She had a kind of denial or defense mechanism. And I think because she was very quickly very successful, unlike some of the other women that Corinne have talked about, she didn't need them to advance her career, nor would she have used that kind of a relationship to advance her career. But she did wonder sometimes if she didn't get a part and someone else did, and she wanted it, and the star and the two stars, the male and female, had a relationship, whether she was losing out because she wasn't... more flexible.
Still
in that
may be
way.
The case. Yeah, I have a curious question for you, though, because she played opposite so many leading men. Mm-hmm. I mean, she played opposite Spencer Tracy, Gary Cooper, Ronald Coleman. There was an infatuation after she worked with Cary Grant that you write about.
She had a crush on Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Yes. So did everybody in the entire universe.
Well,
so.
That's what prompts me to ask you a question because, you know, nowadays you're talking about leading men, and where mm-hmm. are they? You hear that mm-hmm. kind of plea. You hear it almost as a lament. People say Bradley Cooper and okay, you know, but where are those leading men that we saw from yesteryear?
I'm looking for them. I don't know about you, but I'm looking for them. But Cary Grant was probably the first among several. But Ronald Coleman was just wonderful. Even more so for me than Clark Gable, who everyone loves. But there was a kind of suave charm that was part of the movie making business and the storytelling of the era, the glamour, the beautiful photography. I've spent a lot of time thinking about how beautifully photographed movies were. I just saw a new cleaned up version of it happen one night. And the black and whites create that sense of almost allure and glamour.
And this was one of your father's screenplays?
It was one of his many wonderful screenplays.
Yeah, let's talk just for a few moments about him. He worked with Capra and produced and worked with Harry Cohen, as you said, and produced some of the best known classics of that era.
Meet John Doe is one of my favorites and sort of timely, but he also did Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, You Can't Take It With You, Lost Horizon, Lady for a Day,
American Madness. Amazing output.
I think in the 10 years he was at Columbia, 9 years, he did about 26 films.
And you have mixed feelings about Frank Capra, I mean, particularly in relation to his maybe not giving your father his due?
Well, I have mixed feelings about my feelings aren't so much mixed about Frank Capra. I have clear feelings, but it took a whole book to get to the conclusion. I think Frank Capra was a complicated man. He was not a liberal or someone who embraced the idea of the common man or populist by nature. He was always voted Republican. He'd worked hard to build his career. He didn't want FDR to take his money away from him. That was his point of view. But he found a wonderful writer in Robert Riskin.
And they worked together well.
And they worked together extremely well. And I think the tragedy in some ways of the story is that the happiest I think Frank Capra was in his work is when he was working with my father, who was a very warm and generous person. And they had a kind of chemistry that made those films come alive on film. And I don't think he ever quite found that again. He struggled hard to find it in other films when they were no longer working together.
Well, we're talking about Hollywood during the Golden Age and particularly about the role of women during that Golden Age. And we do want to hear from you, our listeners. And I'd be interested in hearing some of your thoughts about Hollywood then compared to Hollywood now, but also if you have questions or some things you'd like to bring to the fore here about Howard Hughes or about Fay Wray, Robert Riskin. We've got certainly a trio of people who can provide answers and important answers who have done the research and who have done, in the case of Victoria Riskin, who's here with us in studio, lived the experiences, but also interested in some of your thoughts, listeners, about those movies and what about those women who were behind the scenes and really played important roles, not only on the screen, but important roles, particularly in making these movies? And I'd like to hear your questions and your thoughts and what comes to your mind. And please feel free to join us and to join this conversation. You can do that now by dialing in at our toll-free number. We're again with Victoria Riskin, Karina Longworth, and Jennifer Smythe. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Who are the heroes you have of that period, and what do you want to know about the Me Too period of the casting couch, which still probably is very much with us? You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Thoughts and reflections on the Golden Age of Hollywood, the studio era age. Karina Longworth is the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom, and Howard Hughes' Hollywood. Jennifer Smythe is the author of Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood. And Victoria Riskin is the author of Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, A Hollywood Memoir. We'll hear from you, our listeners, when we return. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Me Too from Hollywood's Golden Age and its connection to our present age, but also talking about the role of women in Hollywood during that studio era. We have three book authors with us. Karina Longworth is the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood. She's also a film critic and podcaster and created You Must Remember This, a storytelling podcast about the forgotten histories of early Hollywood. And formerly, she was an editor and film critic at the LA Weekly and Village Voice. Jennifer Smythe with us as well, professor of history at the University of Warwick, and she is the author of Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood. And we also have Victoria Riskin here in studio, who's the author of Fay Wray and Robert Riskin, A Hollywood Memoir, former president of the Writers Guild of America West between 2001 and 2004, and she served for 12 years as director of Human Rights Watch. And she'll be appearing this evening at Book Passage in on April 30th, not this evening, correct that, April 30th at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And I'm going to ask you, Victoria, just before we go to our callers. And by the way, let me invite you to join us again. You want to talk about the golden age of Hollywood, or you want to talk about the Me Too movement then as opposed to now, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Your parents were married in the actually in the suite of Wild Bill Donovan, who was the founder of the what would later become the CIA.
That's right. They were Wild Bill Donovan, before he went to work for the government, was a lawyer, and he had represented my mother in the divorce from her first husband, and had been looked after her, been a big support. And then when my father was looking for work to do after the war broke out and their romance had begun, he was looking for the right job in the government. And at that time, Wild Bill Donovan was part of the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA. So my mother arranged a meeting, and it went very well. And he went to work for the government, making movies to tell the story of America and overseas to people living under fascism. And Donovan helped make that happen. And then they got married. My mother proposed to my father. I think that's an important thing to note, that women can propose to men.
He had a relationship with Carol Lombard.
He did.
Your mother had one with Clifford Odets. And so there's all this fascinating history there. I really enjoyed reading, about what went on during the difficult period of the blacklist in your book and in the other books that we're featuring here, and also, of course, FDR and World War II. And that brings up, and let me go to you on this, Jennifer Smythe, it brings up the name, in fact, I'm looking at a listener, Noel, who wants to ask about Ida Lupino.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, Ida Lupino was one of a trio of extremely powerful actresses at Warner Brothers. She went on to be a director and a screenwriter, heralded as one of the two great directors of the golden age of Hollywood. The other colleague of hers, Dorothy Arzner, worked for Harry Cohn at Columbia, so we come back to that name again and again. But Lupino didn't do quite as well at Warner Brothers because she always got the leavings of Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland, and eventually branched out on her own, and was very fortunate as well, too, when her films started coming out in the 40s and early 50s, to have an ally in Hedda Hopper, who was the gossip queen of Hollywood and known for her bad relationship with the Hollywood left. But she was interesting because when it came to supporting women in Hollywood, she crossed political lines. And so I was really surprised looking through her column, coming across all kinds of references in support of Lupino, who was a Democrat, and Hopper also loved Bette Davis. And it was really the tip of the iceberg when I was looking back through, the trades and through a lot of the columns and memoirs during this period, reconstructing a real community of women who had each other's back. And of course, we often forget that the 1940s was a period when the Equal Rights Amendment was important to women in both the Republican and Democratic camps. And it was something that they both advocated for during this period. Unfortunately, didn't get passed, but it came pretty close.
Yeah, Karina Longworth, Jennifer Smythe just mentioned Hedda Hopper, and it's interesting reading in your book to what extent Howard Hughes tried to use Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, for that matter, who were a couple of very powerful women indeed.
Yeah, I mean, Howard Hughes had relationships with all the gossip columnists, and he kind of played them off of each other and would, as a lot of people did, he would trade them a piece of information so that they wouldn't write about something he didn't want them to write. But I'd just like to go back to Ida Lupino. She was known as a Democrat and a big fan of FDR, but in my book,
you write about her in the blacklist, right?
Right. I went through her FBI file, and it has evidence that she did volunteer information to the FBI that helped them blacklist people because she was worried about her own citizenship application. So her legacy, as a female filmmaker is not in doubt. I mean, she's absolutely a feminist icon for that, but it's her political history is much more complicated.
Yeah, and the same is true of Clifford Odets, whom we mentioned earlier, who was a serious suitor of Faye Ray's. But let's go to your calls and let's find out what your thoughts and questions are. We begin, Neil, with you. You're on the air, Neil.
Yeah, I read your book, Seduction, about Howard Hughes. I was not only surprised but baffled. Hughes was widely said to be bisexual, and you don't mention this at all, not even in passing in the book. Wouldn't that explain much of what he did, especially with actresses?
Karina Longworth.
I do mention it, actually, in the section about Katharine Hepburn, that, you know, this is something that has come up in other biographies. I don't think it's widely documented at all.
Let me thank Neil for the call and go right to another caller, and that's caller Robert. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in their writing and their research, finding Hughes, of course, and a number of others that were serious transgressors, and certainly by today's standards would be sexual predators, that as to the view as to what should happen to their work. Should it be put on a shelf? Should there be notations made on the introductions to the work when it's shown that these people were, in fact, violative of women and women's rights? You know, there's a question that comes across as to how far the Me Too movement should go. There's a number of celebrities that have been banned from working, and others that in the past their work has been boycotted. Shouldn't that happen here?
I think you're raising a provocative question, and Professor Smythe, I'll go to you on this. I mean, should these films be shown in schools? Should there be a disclaimer? You know, these are real questions in people's minds.
Well, the thing that...
I mean, really Harvey Weinstein, made some pretty good films, too, you know? I'm sorry.
Yes, he did. Shakespeare in Love, of course. And, you know, there's a case, for example, of David O. Selznick, who was famous for propositioning women during his career. And I think that one executive who was female used to warn other women, you know, when he takes his shoes off, it means that he's going to make a pass at you. But does that discount in any way the great work he did with Gone with the Wind or The First Star is Born? And I think the more information that is out there and the more research we do, that's, you know, all to the good. But do you want to rename all of the Hollywood buildings that bear the names of Louis B. Mayer and Daryl F. Zanuck? Do you want to strike their names from, you know, these monuments and these records? And I don't think that's something that we really want to, you know, to broach. It's a dangerous precedent to do something like that.
Slippery slope. If you get into that area, then maybe you should ban showing A Birth of a Nation, which is a terribly racist film, but it's brilliant cinematography and direction. It's a complicated and tough question, to be sure. And I thank you, Robert, for bringing it up to our attention here. There's a tweet from a listener, and maybe to you on this too, Professor Smythe. Why did it take so long to write about sexual violence in the golden age of Hollywood? Was it just not taken seriously?
Well, it's a difficult question because, I mean, in the press these days, we hear about big bad Hollywood, and we hear that, you know, things have always been bad for women, they've always been victimized. And I think in a way it's unfortunate, because even though there were terrible cases, and of course there's the Patricia Douglas case, which David Sten has written about so extensively, which affected an extra, you have all of these horrible cases, but at the same time, you have women who were dealing with sexual harassment, not just in Hollywood, but throughout the United States. I mean, people will say Rita Hayworth was a great victim, you know, that Harry Cohn was chasing her around the desk and trying to put her in compromising positions. But at the same time, for years, she was sexually abused by her own father. So I think it's sometimes difficult to place all the blame on Hollywood. And at the same time, Hollywood wasn't the originator of the casting couch. That honor goes to Broadway and to the theater, where they actually named the divan in the producer's office the casting couch. So very often, I think we tend to demonize that early period. And when we demonize it, and when we think about these horrific experiences actresses have, we tend to distort the picture that there were women who fought back. There were women who worked together to out some of these predators. There were women who succeeded in spite of these difficulties, and women who, as Victoria mentioned, were quite tight-lipped about their experience and just said, well, I'm you know, going to be an equal partner in this industry, and I'm going to fight for my rights and get on with it, and I'm not going to allow myself to be victimized. So I think it's a pretty complicated picture.
I would say I agree with that. Yeah, because I think I worry that we're painting a picture of this as Hollywood, old Hollywood, being a place where
predators ran wild.
Right, yeah, we're predators. And it was actually a small town where there were many people who were wonderful, decent, caring, bright people who looked after one another. Or someone like, I think about someone like Carol Lombard, who used her profanity with great ease, and it was to scare men off, and it worked. My father was wrote a picture that she was in, and there's a cute story about her coming in to meet with Harry Cohn to see if she was the right one for the picture, and he just
I have to bleep you on both those. I'm sorry. This is radio. There are FCC rules.
I am so sorry about that.
It's okay.
I'm so sorry, but I, what I'm saying is that there was a kind of
that's a great
playful,
story, though.
Playful resilience that a lot of women had, and they were strong and not just victims. And I think we make a mistake if we paint a sort of singular picture. Also, there were many wonderful people who worked in Hollywood. It was a mecca for individuals who had imagination, who were bright, well-educated, either through university or just self-educated, great writers. My own growing up, I felt surrounded by magical people. So while these things did go on and they should be focused on and illuminated, and they tell us how to think about what happens for women today, and we've come a long way, and that's a wonderful thing. As Jennifer points out, women were very strong and very effective and an important part of the power of what happened in Hollywood.
There was just a lot of ordinary relationships, too. I mean,
a lot.
Your parents had a happy marriage for many years. So they had previous marriages, but they, you know, really settled into a life of what comes across in your memoir as harmony and devotion to each other, particularly after your father had a stroke and went through the tragedy of your mother went back to work in the films really to support the family. I mean, it's quite a story. And your dad, well, he was a little, I mentioned, for example, Carol Lombard, but he was also had a relationship with Loretta Young and Glenda Farrell. And,
yes.
Normal relationships by any standards, I suppose. But let's go to more of our callers and see what's on their minds. We go to you, Lisa. You're on. Morning.
Hi. Yes. I just wanted to respond to what was said earlier about banning films that are made by directors who've been sexist. I think that's kind of missing the point of the Me Too movement, which is not to ban any films, but to reexamine the entire body of work of Hollywood that is predominantly heterosexist, sexist, racist. I mean, I went to film school. The standard for a horror film is to scare women. The romantic comedy has to have a happy ending of a woman getting married to a man. This entire genre that Hollywood created is what needs to be reexamined and create new concepts, new narratives, new themes that I think some women directors are starting to do now. But I think we need to look at this a little more deeply. It's not about one sexist man. It's an entire system.
Sense in what you're saying and wisdom. Thank you, Lisa, for that. And here's Gerald, who puts forth an opinion and says power differentials are the key. When women can readily be impoverished by the decisions of certain men, some of them will use that power. Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Anita. Anita, welcome.
I'm on the radio. Hold on. Hi.
Hi.
I am a couple of women who have heavily inspired me in my love for old film is Ruth Gordon, who did so much behind as well as in front of the camera, and then Mae West, who pushed boundaries on film, on stage, write, direct, all that stuff. So maybe we can hear some comments about those two fabulous women.
Yeah, who wants to comment here? You want to say something about either of those women, Jennifer Smythe?
Mae West, obviously. I mean, she's a great favorite of mine, too. And, you know, and she, you know, wrote all of her own scripts. But, you know, because of the production code and the censorship rules that they had in place, you know, she was, you know, like, you know, Victoria had to censor what she said a few minutes ago. There were similar things, you know, operating with Hollywood content as well, too. And her career just, you know, disappeared. She sort of gave up and went off and worked in Broadway and so forth. But, you know, Ruth Gordon, she was famous enough in Hollywood to have really her own biopic. Gene Simmons played her in The Actress in 1953. So she was such a legend at that time that even when she was still, you know, acting, She was the subject of a biographical film. And I don't know. I mean, I'd like to just respond to Lisa's comment, because I think you're absolutely right that Hollywood is it's a place that manufactures racist movies. Absolutely. But I think that in looking back at the period in the 1920s, even 1930s, 1940s, that producers were aware that they had to pay more attention to female audiences. And I think Sam Goldwyn said this very well. He said that it's women who are calling the shots in Hollywood. And there were so many more films that had female protagonists, and they didn't always end up with the guy at the end. They all actually had other interests. They were working women. There were a multiplicity of stories out there for them. And when we think about this period, you know, I go back to Molly Haskell's fantastic book, From Reverence to Rape. We have these wonderful icons like Mae West and Greta Garbo, Katharine Hepburn, Barbara Stanwyck, and they're from this period. And the interesting thing is, you have a lot of women who are writing these scripts. And there were more women who were writing A-list hits in the 30s and 40s than there are now. And more women screenwriters who were part of the guild than there are now. So progress isn't linear in all respects.
And since we were talking a little bit about censorship, and you mentioned it, what about the code in all this as far as women were concerned? Can I get you a comment on that, Jennifer Smite?
Well, the code was completely controlled by men. I don't think there was a single woman involved in the administration of Joseph Breen's office aside from a secretary. But there were all kinds of women who were writing and who were editing, who were trying to work themselves around the code. I don't know. I mean, it's curious.
Yeah, maybe you should explain a little bit about what the code was for our listeners who don't know.
Well, there were all sorts of concerns, and in a way, it has to do with Hollywood's bad reputation that goes back to the 1920s and all sorts of scandals, sex scandals, including ones about the abuse of women. And there was a real sort of fear of the kind of power that Hollywood had over morals. And a lot of this focused not only on behind-the-scenes scandals like the Fatty Arbuckle scandal in the 1920s and the Desmond Taylor scandal, but also content and the kinds of images that were being screened. So too much sex, too much violence, glorifying gangsters, sort of, you know, Howard Hughes had so many brushes with censors who were intent on, you know, cutting some of the more outrageous content in his pictures. And this golden age was a period that was heavily censored in terms of its content. And there was a written document that said, for example, when we were just talking about racism, you couldn't have sexual relations or any kind of relationship really depicted between an African-American and a white person. You couldn't show homosexuality or suggest it. You couldn't insult the Pope. There are all sorts of things that you couldn't do. And behind the scenes, it may seem like producers could do whatever they wanted, but I think they had to be pretty careful, too, because one of the things we forget about these days is that anti-Semitism was so rife at this time. And a lot of producers realized that, you know, they were not beyond the law. They also had to answer occasionally to Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, but they had to be careful because, you know, we call them moguls now, and we don't think about why. And this is a term that it's foreign, and it's part of this sort of wider nativistic fear of Hollywood, that it was a place where Jewish men were running the media and were in enormous positions of power. And it was a dangerous place for them potentially as well, and that's something that we forget.
Let me go back, if I may, Karina Longworth, to you on this, because Howard Hughes had a lot to do with what we just heard Jennifer Smythe talking about, and that is creating this whole image where women were concerned and where women's sexuality was concerned, and really objectifying women in that way.
Yeah, I mean, all of the films that he took a personal hand in producing or directing, he really tried to push the limits of what the censorship board would allow. And you know, I think that there's a misconception from a lot of people that The Outlaw was heavily censored because of its depiction of Jane Russell's breasts. In fact, on the first try, basically, the censorship board approved the film itself. What they had a problem with was the marketing, which was even more risque, which was even more about, like, showing cartoons of Jane Russell's body. In one newspaper ad that Hughes bought to promote that film, there was a cartoon of a man pinning Jane Russell down in a hayloft, which, if you'd seen the film, you'd know is a cartoon about the film's rape scene. So there was these things that really, like, got the censorship board very upset.
We're getting some personal stories here. I'm looking at a listener named Madeline's comments. She writes, at the end of October 1937, 9 weeks after my mother arrived in Hollywood, I was conceived, possibly on the couch, but probably at a Halloween party. I've started researching her life and have found many records and people who were part of her story, but I haven't yet found my father. There's another personal story from Pat. Pat, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been amazing and taken me to all kinds of places. I had to pull over to the side of the road, but I have a question for the author, and it is, how do we get Hollywood to really take responsibility for the role it plays in the toxic masculinity, which I think is the term we need to use? How do we get Hollywood to really live up to what it needs to do in order to rid our whole culture and society of some of the really problematic masculinity problems that we have now?
It's a very good question, Pat. But weren't you going to say something about your mother's story?
Yes. Well, my mother was always enamored with Hollywood, and that's why she came to America from London with my father. My father was an architect, and he got a job at Indiana State University in Terre Haute, Indiana. And my mother had seen all the movies, loved Greta Garbo. I mean, she made me watch them all. Harlow. I mean, I don't even know most of them, but I grew up on Marilyn Monroe, and my mother thought that Hollywood was going to discover her for sure. She was pretty, and she had these dreams, but she was in Terre Haute, Indiana, so it never happened. And she died last November, she still loved Hollywood.
Well, sorry but for your loss. How many young women went there with those dreams, thinking there would be the next Lana Turner, you know, who was discovered at, I guess it was Schwab's drugstore, wasn't it? In fact, Faye Ray was discovered and given, what, $5 parts early on?
Yeah, she was discovered walking down the street, sort of. I mean, she got a little job acting as a clown in a movie, and she just thought she was fabulous, which I think then gave her the courage to go to Hal Roach Studios and walk in. There were no gate guards in those days. And she knocked on the door of the head of production and said, I'd like to have a contract. And he said, fine.
Wasn't her favorite role was not in King Kong? I think it was the Von Stroheim film, wasn't it?
She made a film with Eric Von Stroheim. It was a silent film called The Wedding March. And it was...
She was Mitzi.
Yeah. And... it was a great role, and it's a beautiful film.
You want to take on that question that just came across from the last listener who called in?
About the role of men? Yeah, well, I think films are extraordinarily powerful, and we all know that, and that shapes our view of our culture. I personally think it does matter what stories we write or what films we make and how we portray men and women and how we portray who we are as a culture overseas, because it's a huge part of a huge American export. So I've always been sort of an advocate for telling stories that are truthful.
How aware was your dad of the impact that his screenplays were so much a part of the American imagination and American civilization, really?
Right. Well, right after World War II, when it was coming to an end, there was a big debate about whether or not there was this fear that there were communist ideas that were seeping into films, and that no political ideas, for example, that was the view, should be in films. And he said, you know, every film has influence, so it does matter what you say, but you can't extract point of view or philosophy, you know. And so he thought a lot about what kinds of stories he told and what they were saying about how we needed to be as a culture, particularly during the Depression, when
things were so politically minded.
Things were very
then,
political,
yeah.
And there were, people were suffering a great deal, and there was a great sense of polarization like there is today almost. And his view was, if you could sit down with people and understand who they were, you could... the political divide would fall by the wayside, that we could all solve our problems together. That's a big theme in Meet John Doe, which is the film he made in 1939.
We should mention he was born to a tailor in Brooklyn was his father. I mean, essentially.
Well, they were Jewish immigrants.
Jewish immigrants,
very influenced by the. His father was influenced by the Great Enlightenment philosophy of Judaism, the Tikkun Olam, giving to others, sense of community. Those were things that were kind of baked in.
Here's a caller who wants to know. Well, we'll go to you, Donna. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So you've talked about the leading men in Hollywood, and I grew up enamored with the illusion of the heterosexual male and all of that. And I feel it's tragic on many levels that Hollywood seems to have crafted a lot of, you know, it's been shown that many of the leading men we believed were the, you know, macho men were homosexual or bisexual. And I feel it's tragic that on one hand, we're sending that image across the world because it's a false image. And on the other hand, there's so many people who are not heterosexual, who grew up with this ideal of, you know, the way men were.
Don, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're really at the end of the hour here, and it's an important question. And I'm even looking, another listener knows, wants to know about how lesbians fared in Hollywood back then. Were they worried about being outed? Did producers care about their orientation, or was there room on the casting couch for anyone? Could I go to you quickly on this, Jennifer Spinetta, because we're almost out of time here.
Well, in terms of bisexual stars, I mean, sometimes Hollywood was able to come pretty close to the grain, like with the work of Cary Grant. He was bisexual.
Rock Hudson was, of course, homosexual, and there were many stars.
Yes, and Montgomery Clift as well, too. And I think sometimes in the films, they were able to address this in terms of performance, in the melodrama genre, certainly, and, you know, lesbians in Hollywood as well, too. During the 1930s, okay. You had Greta Garbo cross-dressing in Queen Christina. So
we got to leave it there with Greta Garbo cross-dressing. Thank you so much for being with us, Jennifer Smythe, and thank you, Karina Langworth, and thank you, Victoria Riskin. Michael Krasny here.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.